Welcome to episode 292 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. The United States arguably got a late start on the energy transition, but over the past 3 years, it has been making up for lost time. The Sustainable Energy in America 2024 Factbook from Bloomberg NEF and the Business Council for Sustainable Energy provides the receipts for just how much has happened in such a short time. I'm joined today by Lisa Jacobson of the Council and Tom Roland Rees of BNEF to discuss the U.S. and the race to the low-carbon energy future. So welcome to the interview, Lisa and Tom.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
Well, good Thanks, to have welcome. You. And Tom, good to see you again. Lisa, I want to ask you a general question. And I read a speech that I'm fond of referring to often on this podcast by Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo. And she said that in 2020, during the pandemic, the U.S. finally woke up, and those are her words, to the threat of having its supply chains dominated by China. That was a big impetus for the CHIPS Act, the Infrastructure Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and they realized it was necessary to build clean energy manufacturing capacity at home, to build supply chains at home, or at least, speaking as a Canadian, you know, at least home being North America. Is that a fair take on this, on where we're at?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having both Bloomberg NEF and the Business Council for Sustainable Energy featured on your podcast. It's really an honor. If you look at the headline from this year's Sustainable Energy in America Factbook, the title is "The Clean Energy Transition Thrives, Boosted by Strong Policy Frameworks." And I think what you just referred to with regard to the Secretary of Commerce's comments is spot on. There are many reasons why we need to update our energy infrastructure to both provide more affordable, reliable, secure, and sustainable energy resources to communities and businesses throughout North America, because we do have a North American energy system. It's very important to make sure that policymakers and other stakeholders understand that really we are in a North American market. In order to do that and do it at scale in the way that we need to have secure supply chains for those resources. And so the recent bills that have been enacted at the federal level, the Inflation Reduction Act, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, and even some of the bills that were passed during the COVID period, were all about making sure that we had access to the resources and infrastructure we need here in North America to serve the needs as best we can in North America. That doesn't mean that we won't still have global markets, but we need to do more here at home.
Right, and create a lot of jobs at home, the very important part. Tom, I want to ask you about solar, because that is getting a lot of attention these days. The U.S. is constructing a terrific amount of solar, did so in 23, looks like it'll do it again in 24 and 25. And I often get asked, given that it's intermittent, why bother with wind and solar? And the obvious question is, it's cheap. You know, I've interviewed utility executives that say, look, I can buy wind at a cent, at a 1 cent per kilowatt hour, and solar is 2 cents, and nothing else can match that. Tom, is that the major impetus behind this big expansion of solar?
I mean, I think there's a few different factors at play. A lot of the states in the U.S. have RPS targets that help drive the build of solar, so it's not solely to do with the cost effectiveness of the technology, although it is increasingly becoming more cost effective. And then there's federal tax credits that sometimes, in some cases where it's sort of hanging in the balance, that can tip the balance in favor of solar. So I feel like it's a It's like a stool with three legs. It wouldn't stand without any one of those three things. So they're all important factors that have really driven the build out of solar in the US.
Is American solar manufacturing going to be competitive? And the reason I ask is because I saw a chart from Wood Mackenzie the other day that showed Chinese solar panels were 11 cents a watt, Europe was 22 cents a watt, and the U.S. was 40 cents a watt. What can the U.S. do to bring down those costs?
That's a really good question. And I suppose I would find it very hard to imagine. I mean, the Chinese solar industry has a decade head start on the U.S. solar supply chain. They also control about 90, but I can't remember, it's 95 or 99%, I can't remember which, of the wafer supply in the world. So, you know, and that's a key step in the supply chain. And it's also important to state, and you talk to our global solar team, they point this out quite often, a lot of the companies in China that are making these solar panels aren't particularly profitable either. So the idea that there's going to be a US solar industry scaling up with such a disadvantaged position and is also going to be profitable and competitive with this sort of perpetually oversupplied industry that's in China is difficult to imagine. That doesn't mean that there's no point the US trying to develop supply chains or the government to support that, because it's all about, you know, energy security of supply chains. You know, if they are making it super cheap in China, then, and the US is in a position to take advantage of that, then great. But I don't think that then that should be at the neglect of having a plan B if for whatever reason that there is a change in, say, global dynamics.
Lisa, Carlos Tavares, head of Stellantis the other day, said that the Chinese EV makers are coming for the legacy automakers. And that means GM, Ford, and Stellantis. Are we going to be able to see the U.S. automakers get over their initial, you know, problems with software, with some of their battery platforms, and still be able to compete going forward, so that we see this continued growth in U.S. adoption?
Lots in that question. For me and from my vantage point, I see the consumer, and despite the headlines, as Tom will attest to, when we looked at the data from the fact book this year, we were very happy to see a 50% increase year on year in electric vehicle sales in the United States. We're at 1.46 million cars sold just last year. So I follow the customer. And if the customer increasingly has more offerings, which we are also seeing, there's a more diversification in the manufacturers, as well as the product offerings that consumers are able to purchase. Plus, we have a federal tax credit that is now, you know, moving into its third year. So the market is going to respond. And I think customers are going to want to have increasingly more and more affordable and more variety of options. So that is going to make our U.S. Led manufacturing base respond.
Yeah, I generally agree with you. And GM and Ford have a long history of, they might stumble once in a while, but they generally come around. I'm also interested in your views, Lisa, on the investment that's gone into battery manufacturing. I mean, there's been an enormous amount. I think I saw $100 billion maybe in the last, since the Inflation Reduction Act came out. What's your take on the rise of battery manufacturing in the U.S.?
Well, here too, I think the market is moving. The energy transition is progressing. The U.S. has had, in different sectors, leadership opportunities. We see global demand increasing, and batteries are a critical component of both power and transportation. as well as, you know, in buildings and industrial capabilities. The U.S. wants to have a strong, secure supply chain, and batteries are a part of it. And then we have this market signal that's very strong over a 10-year period in the Inflation Reduction Act, both in terms of domestic manufacturing, as well as in the advanced manufacturing sector. So that together has really made it attractive for both our own organic U.S. Entrepreneurs, as well as businesses from other countries, to come and domicile here in the United States and build battery manufacturing plants.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I talked to a lot of folks in the battery space, and one of the things that comes up all the time is innovation. You know, the Chinese may control supply chain, and they may have scaled up, but nobody has an innovation sector like the Americans have. And do you think that innovation is going to provide the U.S. a competitive advantage as this, you know, industry continues to grow?
I think innovation and just our whole economic culture is why people want to invest here and manufacture in the United States.
Yeah.
I don't know, Tom, if you had any comments on this topic.
Yeah, I would just generally say that it's really, when we're talking about the energy transition, all these different opportunities, you know, we talked about the solar supply chain, but now we're talking about batteries and electric vehicles, and then we could end up talking about hydrogen and other things. I would say, like, it's important to emphasize that electric vehicles and batteries, that's, if we're talking about industrial policy, that's the big one. Like, everything else is if this was a boxing match, that would be the headline fight. Everything else is interesting, but not on the same scale. Like, globally, the two most traded products in the world are cars and oil, and electric vehicles are basically displacing both of those industries. So although I said, you know, maybe the US isn't going to compete with China in the solar supply chain, maybe that's not such a big deal. But batteries is the thing where if you're serious about being an economic powerhouse in the future, you can't afford to not be at that table is when it comes to batteries. There's like the internal combustion engine of tomorrow, in terms of its economic importance. And so the money that has been invested, even if there's this perception that China has maybe got a head start, there's a long way to go in this industry. And I think it is absolutely critical that that industry is supported and that there's a plan for it, because it's the big one. And in terms of innovation, one of the things that is often talked about is the supply chain for minerals. And the response that I always hear is, well, if there's a critical shortage of one particular mineral, there's always the potential for innovation with new battery chemistries. And so I think that's going to be the fascinating dynamic. If the US's game plan, if we can call it that, is to rely on innovation, then maybe battery chemistries is where that is going to play out the most.
Yeah, I interviewed a German company not too long ago, and that was their point. You know, they went from lithium ion NMC, now we're into lithium iron phosphate, and there's just a plethora of chemistries on the horizon. But I wanted to ask you another question about hydrogen. And I have to confess, your colleague, or at least he's a columnist at Bloomberg now, Michael Lieberg, has had a big influence on my thinking about hydrogen. And I still think that there's going to be a role for it, particularly in the industrial space, hard to decarbonize space, but maybe less than we had originally thought. And given that clean hydrogen is kind of just in the pre-takeoff stage, what role might the U.S. play in the hydrogen industry, and what role might hydrogen play in the economy?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think that, you know, if we look at the economy in terms of how it is and say, what would a decarbonized version of that economy look like, then certainly hydrogen increasingly is getting pushed into the niches. Pardon my British accent. I think you say niche in North America.
But not anyway, in Canada. In Canada, we say niche. It's okay.
Oh, okay. But I one of the things that, you know, one of my colleagues who looks at industrial decarbonization pointed out to me is that with the tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act, the US will have on a sort of an OPEX basis incredibly cheap hydrogen. And the question everyone's asking is, well, what do you do with all this hydrogen? But it would make it potentially one of the cheapest, if not the cheapest, producers of virgin green steel, if that ever becomes a thing that is actually, you know, traded at a premium, or even, you know, if there are regulatory frameworks in place that makes that a possible industry. So I think in terms of hydrogen, and like less in terms of what its role will be in the things that are today and what its role could be in a slightly different future. And so if we're talking about the US and hydrogen, the horse that I would kind of put some money on is green steel, and potentially a revival of the US steel industry could be built around the sort of the generous support there is for green hydrogen in the US. So that's just one example. I think it's true that, you know, sometimes hydrogen, it always feels like there's pushback on its actual usefulness. I think that it might be that the real role for hydrogen, whichever country you're in, is yet to be fully discovered. I would just say that it's important to keep an open mind to those sorts of possibilities.
Yeah, fair enough. I've argued. I have folks in the battery and the EV areas who chastise me for even talking about hydrogen. It's so improbable. And I always say, you know what? We should experiment with a lot of clean energy technologies. And some of them may turn out to be not as big as we thought, maybe not as that many applications as we thought, but we won't know that until we try. And maybe, yeah, you know, so we'll see what the future brings for hydrogen. Lisa, I've watched the U.S. Wind industry in its struggles over the last year or two, and I'm wondering what kind of insights you can provide for us on why it's struggling and where it's going to go in the near term.
Well, you know, as we're recording this, which is the beginning of April, you know, we just had some big developments on offshore wind. I mean, I think, you know, obviously there's onshore and offshore, and, you know, Tom speaks very well and on some of the market dynamics. So I'll let him chime in more there. But I mean, some of the things that we've been watching overall for the sector, and to some degree for other renewable sectors too, is the, you know, supply chain, commodity price, high interest rate environments. Plus, we had, you know, a significant amount of policy uncertainty until the Inflation Reduction Act finally was enacted a year and a half ago. So we had a big ramp up of a lot of projects, and also in the wind sector, when there was not clarity on when and how the production tax credit that the wind industry benefits from was going to be extended. And ultimately it was, and we have now this 10-year window for the wind industry to participate. I think there's also been a lot of interest in, as I said, offshore wind. And, you know, as a, like hydrogen, it's an area where there's tremendous enthusiasm, but it's a brand new energy economy in the United States. And there's a lot of regulatory as well as market issues that need to work out. And slowly those are happening. Some would like to see them happen more quickly, but, you know, especially in 2024, there've been some significant developments and we've seen, you know, the first offshore wind project deliver energy on Northeast United States. So, I mean, things are breaking through. You know, it's not always a linear path, but I'm feeling optimistic about both onshore and offshore wind.
Another question for you. National North American Energy Reliability Corporation, NERC, as we energy nerds call it, has been talking a lot in the past year about reliability. And energy policy now, they say, is a major threat, a risk to that reliability. And a lot of it is driven by rapid retirement of thermal generation, and we're not ramping up renewables fast enough. And do you see, is it possible that solar and wind can be ramped up even quicker to kind of make up for that deficiency that NERC has identified?
Never going to be one or two technologies. I mean, and we're talking a lot about the supply side. We need to talk more about the demand side. Because even if we were to kind of meet our short-term objectives in terms of deployment for all the renewables technologies that we have at our disposal, we would still need a lot of demand side happening at the same time. And I don't see the concern about reliability taking away the impetus to move toward a decarbonization of the power sector. Now, in any 1 year or two, we're going to see kind of the ups and downs with this transition, but the long-term trends, I don't see, I don't hear executives and energy purchasers changing the long-term plan. But I'd be interested in what Tom said.
Well, Tom, I have a specific question for you around generation technology, and that is advanced geothermal. And there is a company in Alberta that Ever Technologies that's beginning to scale up. It's got some very cool technology that came out of the oil sands industry. But there's recently been a lot of attention paid to some of the American firms in this space. And are we going to see it emerge as a major generation technology in the next few years?
I mean, I would consider it to be in the same category as the sort of the next wave of potential things. So maybe sitting somewhere in between CCS and advanced nuclear technologies, something that could be potentially really strong, could solve a lot of problems. It's just a bit early to say whether it will, but we should definitely be paying it a lot of attention because, you know, to what we were saying earlier, you know, you have to kind of spread your bets a little bit in this game and try different things. And certainly advanced geothermal seems to be a worthwhile, it would certainly solve a lot of problems, particularly to do with, you know, decarbonizing the last 10% of power. And
potentially providing dispatchable power to replace some of the, maybe some of the thermal generation, but that remains to be seen. Lisa, I got a question for you about what is going on with energy efficiency spending? You know, Amory Lovin's old megawatt is still a pretty good idea. And given that we're electrifying the economy, it would seem that spending on energy efficiency and our energy efficiency data would reflect that.
Well, we are seeing incremental improvements in energy efficient investment and policies over the last decade. Over the last several years, we have not seen the uptick that is needed. And a big focus around the BCSE table, as I was mentioning before, is to focus on the demand side and also grid modernization. You know, how do we really optimize energy systems, look at buildings as in essence batteries? You know, we have the capability with energy management systems and access to the grid to really balance load in ways that we wouldn't have even dreamed of a number of years ago. So we think we definitely need to keep an eye on demand side and invest more. And also we need to make sure, you know, that all of our policies are looking at the demand side as much as the supply side.
We've got about 3 minutes left. Could you give me in 1 minute, if you don't mind, your take on the evolution of the U.S. grid? Obviously, some parts are, portions of it are more advanced in modernization, becoming a smart grid than others, but just your general take on where it's likely to go in the next few years.
Well, the big conversation is about continuing to modernize and expand the transmission grid. And then how to better utilize our natural gas infrastructure. And we talked about hydrogen before. You know, we have billions of dollars of very sophisticated electric and natural gas infrastructure. Now we got to put it to the test to decarbonize. So we're working on a lot of policies and community planning to enable us to do that.
Tom, same question for you, sir. If you could just give us a minute of your take on the evolution, where the American power grids are going.
I mean, I would echo a lot of what Lisa is saying, is that the ability to build out transmission to really leverage the resources in different parts of the country is critical. There's also this question of reliability, and this sound, I know this is a very sort of a cheap soundbite, when people talk about the danger that retiring thermal plants poses to reliability, I don't have a stat, but like every time I hear about an outage in the US, it's because of extreme weather events. And that is the big irony to me. But sort of on that point, it is also because extreme weather events frequently damaging vulnerable distribution grid infrastructure. And so maybe more constructively, I would say that there is also room for investment in the US distribution grid to make it more reliable, particularly if we're looking to electrify industry and other sectors, then it becomes that much more critical.
Well, thank you very much to the two of you. This has been very interesting. And the energy transition in the U.S. now has become very interesting. There's lots of rapid change, lots of trends for us to keep our finger on the pulse of. So we'll be talking to you in the future. Thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
Thank you.